vote despite the threat, serious threat of being murdered and being murdered themselves. Now, these were some, this is examples of what humans can do and have done. And we see many signs of it today, and that's the basis for hope.
Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, author, speaking to us from Tucson, where he is now sheltering at home. Laureate professor, University of Arizona, taught at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for more than half a century. That does it for our show. Amidst the pandemic, we still want to wish a very safe and healthy birthday to Democracy Now!'s David Prude, Anna Uzbek, and Maria Taracena. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. A majority of our amazing team is working from home. Thanks to all. I'm Amy Goodman. Be safe.
KBOO is responding to the COVID-19 pandemic in our community. Tune in and check our website for updates at kboo.fm/COVID-19. And don't forget to donate. Community radio is essential in times of crisis, and we depend on you to keep us going.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue our coverage of the growing global movement of environmentalists and caregivers. We bring you a recent webinar that explored the implications of a campaign for a care income in the global South and North to stop climate change, promote caring work for people and planet, and refuse work that is destructive to the environment and to the worker. The Global Women's Strike and Women of Color Global Women's Strike, who have pressed for financial recognition for unwage caring work, have come together with the Green New Deal for Europe to press governments everywhere to provide a care income. They say it would prioritize and support the work of all those in the global South and North of every gender who care for people, for the urban and rural environment, and for the natural world. Furthermore, they make the case that the care income is quite different from the universal basic income, which they say does not acknowledge or prioritize caring work nor the climate emergency. Thus far, the call has the support of organizations and individuals from 33 countries around the world. They also make the case that this pandemic should make it clear that we cannot go back to economic and social policies that destroy people and the planet. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. We go to the webinar that explored the implications of a campaign for a care income North and South to stop climate change, promote caring work for people and planet, and refuse work that is destructive to the environment and to the worker. I, by the way, chaired the webinar. During the first half of today's program, you will hear presentations by Selma James, a founder of the Wages for Housework campaign and an international coordinator of the Global Women's Strike. She's an activist, author, strategist, critical thinker, women's rights, and anti-racist campaigner. She is the widow of C.L.R. James, the author of Black Jacobins, the major text on the Haitian Revolution. She is the author of Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings from 1952 to 2011. You will also hear from Dr. Stefania Barca, a senior researcher at the University of Coimbra in Portugal. She holds her doctorate in economic history and has been a visiting scholar at Yale University, a postdoctoral fellow at UC Berkeley, and guest professor at Lund University. In the past decade, she has published widely on the political ecology of industrial capitalism, with focus on labor and environmental politics, environmental justice, and degrowth. She has recently co-edited the book collection Towards the Political Economy of Degrowth. She has also been active in shaping a Green New Deal policy for Europe. First, we will hear from Selma James, followed by Dr. Stefania Barca.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be on. We found the Green New Deal for Europe when we saw that they had come out for a CARE income. As Margaret has explained, we have been fighting for the recognition and payment of caring for many years, but now it was for a care income, that is, for the care of people and for the care of the planet, which meant that what the Green New Deal for Europe was proposing was that the two great movements for the liberation of the human race and the care of people and the treatment of the planet, which would enable it to regenerate and survive, were coming together, these two movements, so that work for caring for people and work for caring for the environment would both be work that was respected and paid for. Now, I want to make it clear that payment was not because the work was worth so much. It was because the work was invaluable, and therefore the people who did this work had to be remunerated in ways that would enable them to live a decent life. That would first of all be the liberation of women. We would be liberated from our poverty, from our overwork, from our subservience, and this would enable us to be full participants in the transformation of the world. It would also mean the liberation of the waged worker, not merely the unwaged woman, the carer, the reproducer of the human race, but all of us who go out to work, who have very little ourselves, but who are involved as work, as things we must do in polluting the planet. We don't want to do that work. We don't want to do it because we hate the work and because the work that it and the, what it performs is not what we need, not what we want. We want exactly the opposite. So this was our chance, really, to bring the movements together and prioritize the work that women do, the caring work that women do, which would enable us to have a new perspective for the economy and for everything in the world, which would be that people are what mattered, that the planet is what mattered, not profit or the market. I want to make just one other point. It says the Green New Deal for Europe, but it is first of all international in its outlook. And we are international in the way we are proceeding for the care income everywhere in the world. We have some things that we want to say about it. First of all, we look at the struggles that women and men in the South have made, and we begin to see the outline of what they want to produce. And we have to, in the way of a newer society, in a society that is liberated and not exploitative, and from there we can begin to understand what we are part of, because that is our movement too. But in addition, it is a movement against the new exploitation which the West has been imposing and which it calls green technology. Green technology can be read that you paint exploitation green. We have none of it. We are against it. We are part of the struggle against it. We refuse it. We also must say, we in Europe must say that the resources that are in Europe are at the disposal of every movement, beginning perhaps in the South, which has been robbed most generously by the North. I just want to say that the speakers today are beginning to explore another way of looking at the ecology movement, and it does the job, I think, of beginning to demystify waged work. We women have been told that to go in the West especially, but everywhere, have been told that going out to work is a liberation. We never believed it. And people who have done that work, like myself, are outraged that exploitation of any sort, but exploitation of women especially anywhere, is a liberation. Just one final point, and that is, what we are proposing is the end of overwork and poverty, and that's where we want to go.
So thanks a lot to Nina Lopez and Selma James for inviting us to contribute to this webinar. We also participated in the previous one, and it was a very wonderful and very enriching experience. I will be talking on behalf of myself and Giacomo, because we are both involved in this Green New Deal for Europe platform that Selma was mentioning before, together with Selma and Nina. Together, the four of us, we have been interacting during the elaboration of the document and talking about this idea of a care income. So what I will do today, I will give you a brief introduction to this European Green New Deal, just to give you an idea of what is it that we're talking about. And then I will explain what we mean by care income, what is the idea that we are trying to put forward. So in the early January of this year, the European Commission has approved a Green Deal. And this is an investment plan to reduce carbon emissions in Europe. This is a neoliberal plan, a neoliberal response to the climate protests of the past few years. The Commission's plan is based on principles of green growth and the technofix that Selma was also mentioning before, that we are rejecting. The plan gives money to the private sector to invest in greening production. And this plan is informed by the perverse logic of trickle-down economics. The perverse logic of trickle-down, it means that only if the market economy grows, does funding become available to compensate for the damage caused by growth itself, including climate change and increasing inequality. This is the perverse logic. But this is not the only plan available. In the same months in which the Commission was working on its plan, there was a network of researchers, intellectuals, and activists from all over Europe that was formed to work on an alternative plan called the Green New Deal for Europe. And then to include this plan in a large campaign of mobilization for the democratization of the European economy and of anti-crisis policies. So the basic idea is that the economic democracy, that people have a right, European people have a right to have a say on the economic policies that are being formulated against the crisis, both the climate crisis and the social crisis and the crisis of care. So the result of this process in which we participated was a document called A Blueprint for Europe's Just Transition. So the document adopts the language of just transition, which is an international concept that has been elaborated by the trade unions movement and by the indigenous and environmental justice organizations in many other countries. The difference between this and the European Commission plan is radical. The GNDE, the Green New Deal for Europe, is based on redistributive public finance criteria, and it gives priority to the fight against inequalities and environmental injustice and to economic democracy, and rejects the priority of GDP growth over social policies. While that of the Commission is a top-down program addressed to the governments of EU countries to adopt market incentives for the benefit of companies, the GNDE is a political platform. It is addressed to social movements, and it offers a strategic project, a strategic platform aimed at urging broad mobilizations from below. Basically, what the GNDE is a set of policy recommendations whose main objective is the systemic transformation of European institutions to make possible an equitable running of the economy without GDP growth, so that the climate and ecology can be rapidly repaired while also granting social justice at the same time. I want to signal here two key mechanisms of the Green New Deal. The first is the institution of a new public agency called the Green Public Works Agency that gives money to local communities rather than to the private sectors to generate millions of new public jobs in climate restoration projects. And second is the institution of an Environmental Justice Commission, an independent body of research, monitor, and advice to EU policymakers to make sure that whatever policies and policy measures are taken in within the European Green New Deal are not causing environmental injustice, are not causing environmental costs in any part, in any community, within and outside Europe. So in our opinion, the GNDE represents a historic opportunity for an economic revolution orientated by feminist and environmental justice principles. This is why we decided to accept the invitation of being part of the group. To ensure an equitable transition to a post-carbon economy, the plan shifts the focus of collective well-being and welfare from industrial production to social and environmental reproduction, and so to the maintenance, recycling, repair, and restoration of environmental and social infrastructures. In short, to the work of care for both people and for the environment. The care income is a key pillar of the GNDE. By care income, we mean direct and indirect compensation to be made available to all those who are engaged in life-supporting activities, unpaid life-supporting activities, like the care of people and or of the urban and rural environments that make life possible, both in the home and in the community and in the ecosystem. How have we come to this definition? We know from decades of ecofeminist struggles and from the environmental justice movement, mostly led by racialized and working class women all over the world, we have learned from them about the nexus between human bodies and their environments, and between the work of caring for human life and human health, and the work of caring for water, air, soil, forests, and the non-human world in general, that supports life everywhere. This nexus that is so difficult to recognize for the politicians and for the economists, it's clear and obvious for millions of people everywhere, and is becoming centerpiece in the new climate justice movement, including the younger generations. So the care income proposal reflects this long-standing socio-ecological awareness and gives it full expression in terms of economic policy. The care income aims to compensate directly and indirectly all the work that countless people are already doing to support life against capital. For example, by organizing collective defense against extractivism and ecological degradation, or through thousands of alternative practices at the community level that contribute to the rehabilitation and care of the commons. These practices of care for life have been fundamental to sustaining the human community through the COVID pandemic and are greatly supporting our ability to respond to it. It is high time to recognize that this is the kind of work that societies truly need and to reward it fairly so that our wealth does not depend anymore on jobs that deplete our bodies and destroy the natural world in a vicious circle of profit from degradation. In short, the care income is based on principles of ecofeminism and environmental justice. It recognizes the structural interdependence between human and non-human well-being, between peoples and environmental health, and supports the work of those who are taking care of it. Therefore, the care income does not advocate for social policies based on oil-related income coming from extractive activities which destroy the non-human world, compromise food sovereignty, and imply the sacrifice of some territories and the communities who inhabit them. Inspired by ecofeminist and indigenous visions and struggles, the care income recognizes that the only possible long-term wealth and prosperity is that founded on reconnecting the human with the web of life. Incorporating this proposal within its overall plan of financial and policy measures, the GNDE demonstrates that such revolutionary idea of wealth is not only necessary, but it is possible. It is a matter of political will, and this will must be solicited by struggles from the largest possible social coalitions. The care income, we believe, is a key strategic demand of the GNDE that responds to true social needs, especially at the time of enormous overburdening of care work like the one we are going through. It is important to mention, though, that the care income is fundamentally different from other proposals of basic income. In one respect, it does not represent an abstract universal right to income that is equal for anyone independently on their social position, but rather a recognition and valuation of the immense amount of reproductive and care work that is normally expended in any society, and the recognition of how this work is fundamentally needed to enhance life, and is equally, if not more important, that so-called productive work. The aim of the care income is not, like a universal basic income, that of guaranteeing a minimum level of access to goods and services on the part of everyone. It is, on the contrary, that of fairly compensating the contribution that reproductive workers give to society and the planet, work that is normalized and invisible. By compensating it both directly and indirectly, the care income makes this work a cornerstone of social wealth. In short, the care income is not universal and abstract, but embodied and materialist. It is worth repeating before ending that the care income is not a unique solution for all social problems, but only one among a number of policy measures that are articulated with each other to respond to the unprecedented crisis of our times. I just want to mention two very important demands that the GNDE articulates with the CI in the wake of the COVID pandemic. First, to adopt a European health and care standard that raises the bar for decent health and universal social protection provision and directs resources toward regions that fall below this standard to begin rebalancing health and care outcomes across Europe. Second, to fund a major buyback program for vacant housing stock. Social distancing is a privilege that is not available to everyone. With 38 million vacant homes around the continent, Europe can provide shelter for all who need it. So to conclude, we think the GNDE campaign is a historic opportunity and a resource of enormous importance for developing a feminist rethinking of the economy capable of meeting the climate challenge of our time. Thank you.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we will continue our coverage of a recent webinar that took place focusing on the environment and caregivers. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. What you want? Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you are on Facebook, you can look for us and like us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. You can go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us today. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in upstate New York. That's upstate New York, and internationally to our SoundCloud listeners in Portugal. Now, we return to a broadcast of a webinar held on April 3rd, 2020 on the implications of a campaign for a care income to stop climate change, promote caring work for people and planet, and refuse work that is destructive to the environment as well as to the worker. You will now hear presentations by Sam Weinstein, Solvig Francis, Pranom Samwong, and Nina Lopez. Sam Weinstein is a retired official from the National Office of the Utility Workers Union of America. Now London-based, he is active with the Camden branch of Momentum, a regional grassroots network. He's also a member of Payday Men's Network, an international and multiracial network of men which work with the Global Women's Strike. Solvig Francis grew up in Zambia. She was a founding member of the Crossroads Women's Center in London, England, way back in 1975. She is a breastfeeding advocate, an expert in valuations of unwaged work, and co-author of the book, The Milk of Human Kindness. Pranom Samwong is from Protection International, Thailand. She works for and with community women human rights defenders, the majority of whom are engaged in struggles for life and against mining and mega development projects. Nina Lopez hails from Argentina, now living in London, England. She is with Legal Action for Women and is a co-coordinator of the Global Women's Strike, and she pretty much made a call to action wrapping up the webinar. First, we will hear from Sam Weinstein and then from Solvig Francis, going on to Pranom Samwong, followed by Nina Lopez.
First, let me say that Payday is a network of men working with the Global Women's Strike internationally. We are delighted to endorse the Care Income Now campaign. While the vast majority of carers are women, there are men who do the work and deserve the money like our sisters. But overwhelmingly, men are either a reserve army of labor or locked into jobs that pollute, destroy, police, or maim both the worker and her, his community, including your own family. As one retired worker said, you are trading your body for money, selling your health to support your family. But if you are unemployed, you feel desperate to get one of those jobs where you spend your time literally wishing your life away while the work itself shortens it. In my experience, most people hate their jobs and spend their lives trying to avoid work. They want to do something else. A care income would be an encouragement and make that possible. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, there has been a huge social movement to make the environment of the worker safe. Yet to this day, 2.8 million people die every year from work-related disease and injury, and 374 million suffer non-fatal injuries on the job. I carry permanent injuries and scars from nearly every manual job I ever did. On the blast furnace, the heat was so intense that despite protective clothing, it dried my knuckles up And I literally had to ply my fingers open every morning. When I blew my nose, it came out black, and that continued for weeks after I quit the job. I won't bore you with the rest. One job with untold casualties each year is not counted in these work-related stats, but is particularly associated with being a real man. It's the military. Be all you can be is what they say in the U.S. They don't want us to know the total number of either military or civilian casualties of endless wars. We do know that the U.S. military, the single greatest polluter on Earth, has been fighting environmentally devastating wars in the Middle East to protect the largest polluting industry of all, oil and gas. That's what they do. That's what they're known for. Payday has a long history of supporting whistleblowers and people who refuse to do the killing work of the military, like Stephen Funk, Aaron Watada, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and the many Israeli conscripts who have gone to jail repeatedly rather than participate in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Payday's slogan is refusing to kill or be killed. And I suspect the earlier statistics don't include so-called, quote, factory farms, where much of our food is grown, picked often by migrant workers made up of whole families that take the brunt of literally back-breaking work and oceans of poisonous pesticides with which the crops are bombed and which all of us later consume. There is now a massive movement for regenerative farming, about which Dean, who is on this call, will hopefully say more later. The earlier disease and injury statistics are dwarfed by the more than 4 million deaths annually from exposure to household air pollution due to the unpaid work of cooking on inefficient biomass stoves. Overwhelmingly poor women of color in the global South cook on those. Talk about needing a care income and a lot of workers' compensation. On top of pollution and destruction of the worker is the pollution and destruction of the workers' community. The most polluting factories are inevitably located in the poorest areas. Bhopal and Chernobyl are two of the best known industrial disasters, each costing thousands of lives in their immediate future, in their surrounding communities, but they are only the tip of the iceberg. A lot of white-collar jobs are also unnecessary, mind-numbing, or support the very deadly physical work I mentioned before. A few words about unnecessary. When I was a gas man, a lot of the work I did was on meters or collecting bills from people who couldn't afford to pay. It was useless work done to make a profit for the company by policing consumers based on their need for heating and cooking. Things that should be a human right. There are lots of jobs like that. But there are notable examples of men making a fight for the right to be carers or to make things not destructive of society. The Lucas Plan in the 70s was just such an attempt. Faced with downsizing, workers at Lucas Aerospace making military equipment proposed to management that they stop producing weapons, but instead retool to develop socially useful goods, like solar heating equipment, and this was in the old days when that really nobody was talking about solar heating equipment, and artificial kidneys, something which was desperately needed at the time and new on the market. They wanted to design the work so that the workers would be motivated by the social value of the work they were actually doing. They knew that workers were the real experts. Unfortunately, these workers got little support from the union, and some were fired by an outraged company. Most unions have, unfortunately, been unwilling to challenge management's prerogative to manage what it produced in the workplace. The bureaucracy is terrified of both losing its membership and therefore the institution and their own personal jobs, but also of their members being driven into the ranks of the unemployed. Blind to campaigning for something like the care income, they end up supporting the employer, however harmful to their members and the community at large. But not all. It's wonderful to see, for instance, that the Bakers Union in the UK have endorsed this campaign, and we expect that more will sign on. We sincerely hope so. Also in Germany, a few years ago, 1.5 million members of IG Metall, a heavy engineering union, went on strike for the right to work only 28 hours per week at full pay with the intent of taking more responsibility for their families. Imagine that. The men believed that the way to achieve a shorter work week was to demand the time and money for caring work. They didn't win everything, but as one union spokesperson said, "We want employers to recognize that traditional gender roles in modern families are changing, and we want workers to have the chance to do work that is important to society." Obviously, he didn't think that caring work in the he did think that caring work in the family was a lot more important to society than what was being done in the engineering sector. And a few days ago, workers building military aircraft engines at a General Electric plant in Massachusetts walked off the job, demanding that production be shifted to the urgent necessity of breathing ventilators, a demand to invest in caring, not killing. Margaret mentioned that I was involved in a huge pay equity settlement. We put the largest classification of women, those who worked in the call center, on the same pay scale as the largest classification of men who worked, as I had, in and around customers' homes, a raise of 13% for the women. The methodology used in that broke the jobs down into their constituent parts and showed that the women in the call center, the shock absorbers for the gas company, were multitasking in a similar way to managers, a skill that most of the women used regularly, doing unpaid work in the home. But once we raised call center pay, guess what happened? Men poured into the job. Pay the women properly and the men will come. Let me end by saying we don't know what work is really necessary. The military is not. We know that care work is, and a care work is an invitation to do that work and the beginning of finding out about all the rest. Thank you, Margaret.
Yes, it's great hearing these presentations, which you feel really all, you know, support breastfeeding. And just really everything about breastfeeding makes sense. And many of us already have a good idea of its multitude of benefits as a superfood for babies. Breast milk provides a powerful immunity boost, so breastfed babies are less prone to a whole range of potentially fatal infections and other illnesses into adulthood. Breastfeeding continues the work of the placenta. It is part of making a human being, all animals in fact, and we must do as much as we can not to leave that part out. It saves mothers' lives, for example, less hemorrhaging after birth. And while expensive formula ravages the environment at every stage of production, breastfeeding is the most sustainable food going. A favorite breastfeeding placard at our center is plastic-free, beautifully packaged. But what doesn't make sense then is that breastfeeding mothers are not recognized as workers. Breastfeeding is not seen as an essential part of our caring work that is both biological and social and makes an enormous economic contribution, for example, savings to health services. Yet we are not supported in this work and often don't have financial or food security. We can even be punished for breastfeeding. A sad stat here in the UK is that 81% of mothers start breastfeeding, but over a third stop by 6 weeks. Many say they stop earlier than they wanted because of lack of support and financial pressures. I think rates will vary in the other countries represented on this webinar, and I think it will be, you know, a similar story. But breastfeeding is under attack worldwide. And very often, even where we have won paid maternity leave, which I know is by far not everywhere, it's often too low. For example, here in the UK, it's a third of the average wage, pushing us to return to work sooner. And the almost universal huge pressure that women must have a job out of the home, no matter what the work is or the age of the child, also devalues this caring work. For women on welfare, it is enforced by compulsory interviews and sanctions. And breastfeeding mothers in prison are separated from their babies, as they can be in asylum detention.
social workers and the family courts don't hesitate to brutally snatch a breastfeeding child into care or hand custody to the father. And the cost in lives is staggering. Worldwide, over 800,000 babies under one, mostly in countries of the global south, die every year from lack of breastfeeding. A silent genocide goes on while the multinational formula industry racks up profits of over $70 billion. So what could it mean if breastfeeding mothers were paid a care income and other resources? We can get a sense where breastfeeding mothers are valued. For example, in Norway, 99% of women start breastfeeding and 80% still are at 6 months. But it wasn't always like that. In the 70s, a mother-led campaign forced the government to act. Formula advertising was banned. Breast milk is valued in the gross national product. Maternity leave is 49 weeks at full pay, with more paid leave after that. Breastfeeding breaks are paid. And in the UK, new mothers in a working class community were paid in the form of vouchers to breastfeed. Significantly more mothers breastfed and for longer. Imagine the result if it was a guaranteed cash income to breastfeed for as long as the World Health Organization recommends. Parts of Africa remain bastions of breastfeeding that must be protected and spread for all of our sakes and the planet. Even low-income countries provide paid breastfeeding breaks, e.g. Rwanda, Tanzania. And at community level, a strong breastfeeding culture is upheld. For example, grandmothers led the fight against their daughters being pressured to feed their infants formula during the HIV crisis, knowing that formula was a death sentence. And this led to a change in policy. A few things that a care income, whatever form it takes, for this life-supporting work could do: validate and strengthen our struggles everywhere to defend breastfeeding, undermine formula industry lies and profits and put resources our way, help us, our loved ones and society, respect our biological and caring work, give us food security, allow us time to prioritize breastfeeding over other worries and demands, help provide our children with what they need. Babies need breast milk to be in close physical contact with their mother, and for their caregivers to be supported in every possible way.
Women in Thailand carry the responsibility of caring of our extended family. That goes the same with the women in the other country in Asia and Latin America. But I like to start with a bit of the context. Rural, indigenous, and urban poor women have been organizing and they're fighting to be included in the public consultation and decision-making process, especially regarding issue of the land occupancy and management of the national resources. Women who are human rights defenders lived and work in the same repressive environment as the other women, facing the same barriers and carrying the same responsibilities of care. For example, women human rights defenders from the community or rural base working for at least 12 hours without pay. However, those who become women human rights defenders significantly increase both of their burden of the care and their risk. Many people have been killed or disappeared simply trying to protect life, protecting land, and protecting the environment. The community-based women human rights defenders especially have been denied the right to formal education and have little access to resources or finance support for their work. So by taking the leadership in the fight for human rights, women human rights defenders break the traditional and can be punished for not complying with the rigid class and the gender norms or gender roles. For example, at-risk women human rights offenders in Mesoamerica consistently report that being shamed as a bad mother or being accused of having an affair is devastating because it creates conflicts within their own families. The one place, the family, that should provide a sense of belonging and security to women. Around the world, the perception of women as the primary caregivers, as well as the reality that women are often responsible for the care of the family members, plays an important part in motivation of perpetrators to target their family members. I'd like to take you back to Thailand. In the last 5 years, the poverty rate in Thailand grew from 8% to 10%. And the absolute number of the people living in poverty is increased from 4 million to more than 6.7 million. As you know, we under military government since 2014, even we had election, but we getting back the military in the government. The military men in power keep using public resources to benefit their own interest. That is very clear. There is an increasing inland confiscation and lack of consultation on introduction of infrastructure projects. The environment is being poisoned and extractive industries are expanding. Families and communities are being displaced throughout Thailand, and we know this is also happening around the world. It's impacting particularly on the women and the women who do the care work. Most of the women human rights defenders I work for and with are caring for land and caring for environment and the people. They provide food security to family and the community. Rural women's care roles, including farming, and also again, caring for the family and the community. Rural women in all of their village play a major role in all aspects of growing rice, including seed preparation, transplanting, weeding, compost application, and harvesting. This is the unwages work of the rural women in addition to the family care in the home. One community, the Southern Pesan Federation of Thailand, which is our close comrade and the partner, and I think some of you may know them and have supported them, we call SPFT. SPFT was created in 2008 when a handful of the farming communities, women and men, met and they agreed that their existing and surviving were rooted in their connection to the land and to each other. They farm land collectively, and the women of SPFT lead the SPFT seed serving initiatives. SPFT has been engaged in the struggle for the right to use the land against the palm oil company for over a decade. Now they become a model of organizing in grassroots and also organizing model in terms of committee land title. But the risky and the exhausting work of resistance is also another part of the SPFT women's caring work. Women human rights defenders and their movement are not just the target of violence. We would like to take a good note on that. They are also innovator of effective self-defense strategies as a method of survival and the resistance. Many grassroots organizations and networks integrated some form of the self-defense and solidarity into their way of organizing, and they do that every day. They are determined to be an autonomous, they're very determined to be self-sustaining group, actively contributing to the new form of the social, new form of economy and political relations. For example, the which women of Guatemala defend their territorial primarily through decision-making assembly or the communal care or economic solidarity, community guarding force and emergency communication plans. It's enabling them to both preventing extractive companies from entering their land, but also creating an alternative way of living. And this is exactly what SPFT in Thailand also doing the similar thing. From my personal point of view, but I think maybe some of you may agree, the international community has much to learn from the approaches of the grassroots movement and the community. In one community in northeast of Thailand, we call Nong Bua Lumpu, that's the name of the area. They have been fighting against stone mining for the last 20 years. They lost 4 members of that group. Recently, there are some of local academic together with the community start to do some little research, and they found out that yearly the people collecting the bamboo shoot from the forest, community forest, around 70,000 kilograms per year from the forest. This is a forest they fight to protect, and it is just better than a supermarket for women. Since every day women can go to this forest, they are harvesting the mushroom, the bamboo shoot, and many herbs, which is economically value over $3 million a year. But again, the work of the women who carrying off these forests is not yet recognized or valued economically.
The care income is short on technical details, and that is exactly how we want it, because it's not, it hasn't been put forward by technocrats, which is very unusual for for any kind of proposals called the Green New Deal of any kind.
And coming from academia.
And it's coming, it's what they're trying to do when they put it forward, which we very much got involved precisely to do, is because it's a movement building proposal. And together we can work out what the different countries want, what the different communities want, what they think they could win at a particular moment, how to make the case, how to incorporate it into whatever campaigns and movements are already going on. I think that's really important, that we don't get caught in trying to figure out every little detail of what does this mean and what does that mean. We're just moving away from that. It's really a new way of looking at things, which is really the way that women who do the caring work, in a way, have always looked at it. Except that now we're saying the whole economy should be looking at it in that way. You know, all the policies should be looking at it in that way. And the climate crisis, in a way, has given us this opportunity, precisely because what is the point of being a billionaire if everything is getting flooded and you can't grow food anywhere? I mean, let's face it. You know, the crisis is really at that breaking point, so we have to address it. And a care income gives us a way to address it wherever you are, as well as many other demands, of course, that people have. So, Stefania, we very much appreciate the way that you look at it, and Giacomo making the point that we're moving away from productive, non-productive definitions, as in GDP and all that, which have always left us out and left out what's really important, which is our survival and our well-being.
We are out of time. I would like to thank all of today's speakers and to the organizers of the webinar and the Care Income Now campaign. I would also like to thank Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we bring rock and roll back to you. We listen to